A remote hearing of the Capital Investment Committee for March 1st is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance with House Rule 10.01 and is being live streamed by the House Public Information Office. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Chair Lee.
Lee present.
Lee present. Vice Chair Murphy.
Murphy present.
Murphy present. Representative Erdahl.
Erdahl present.
Erdahl present. Representative Egbadje.
Present.
Egbadje present. Representative Berg?
Present.
Berg present. Representative Davids?
Davids present.
Davids present. Representative Frankie?
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Representative Freiberg?
Present.
Freiberg present. Representative Hansen?
Present.
Hansen present. Representative Hewitt?
Present.
Hewitt present. Representative Lilly?
Lilly present.
Lilly present. Representative Lucero?
Lucero present.
Lucero present. Representative Moran?
Present.
Moran present. Representative Pearson?
Pearson present.
Pearson present. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh present.
Raleigh present. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen present.
Rasmussen present. Representative Ryer?
Ryer present.
Ryer present. Representative West?
West present.
West present. And Representative Zhang?
Zhang present.
Zhang present. Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
A quorum is present. Chair Murphy, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for Thursday, February 24th?
I move approval of the minutes for Thursday, February 24th as they were printed.
Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for Thursday, February 4th. Any discussion members? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for Thursday, February 24th are approved. Members, we have another full agenda today. As is our custom, all the bills will be heard on an informational-only basis. Amendments can be offered for reference only. Today, we will hear testimony on bills that helped us address the Minnesota housing crisis. And with that, first on the agenda is House File 3244, Chair Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we should check first. I believe today is Representative Rick Hansen's birthday. And so we should say happy birthday to Representative Hansen to start off.
Happy birthday, Chair Hansen. Go ahead, Chair Hausman.
Thank you. House File 3244 is a Homes for All agenda. Just a bit of history to set the context. Before 2012, the state did very little on housing, particularly bonding and building. We had maybe $2 million of geo-bonding in a bonding bill. And then a couple of things happened. One, Homes for All Coalition organized, and thousands of people around the state began to work together on advancing a housing agenda. And second, Minnesota Housing asked if they could use their own bonding authority and have appropriation bonds and use them as housing infrastructure bonds, because then they could partner with nonprofits, Lutheran Social Service, Catholic Charities, Common Bond, Beacon, Aon. And I think we leveraged $3 of private money for every dollar of state money. So those two were sort of life-changing. And in 2014, we began to see some much more significant investment. That year, we did $80 million in housing infrastructure bonds and $20 million in geo-bonding. Geo-bonding, as you know, can only be used for public infrastructure. And so that continues to be the tool we use for public housing. House File 3244 asks for $400 million for housing infrastructure bonds and $100 million for geo-bonding. To set those in context of need, Minnesota Housing tells us whenever they report that housing infrastructure bonds at the current funding levels, the agency says no to three of every four requests. That's how much more need there is out there and good work being done. On public housing, the current needs statewide, and there's public housing all over the state, the current needs for statewide total more than $354 million. So $100 million goes a little ways, but we still have more work to do. And then the bill also extends eligibility to construction, acquisition, and rehab of permanent housing to households earning 50% of area median income with preference to projects that will provide housing affordable to households at or below 30% of the AMI. That's a brief introduction. We have some testifiers.
All right, I think first on the agenda is Ms. Underwood. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Great, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and happy birthday, Representative Hansen. For the record, I am Wendy Underwood, Vice President of Social Justice Advocacy and Engagement at Catholic Charities of St. Paul and Minneapolis. I'm very pleased to be here today to speak in favor of House File 3244 on behalf of Homes for All and for the hundreds of residents at Catholic Charities housing sites who have a permanent home today because of housing infrastructure bonds. I am also very pleased to see in the bill a preference for those housing projects at or below 30% AMI. Catholic Charities is known in the region for providing emergency shelter services, and to that end, we also support the shelter capital bill you are hearing today. But we are also one of the largest providers of permanent supportive housing, with 950 current apartments rented to Minnesotans who have experienced long-term homelessness or who have other health and physical challenges. Many are veterans. We are excited to share that, thanks to this committee's commitment to HIBs and to the hard work of local partners, we will be opening a new location this spring. With the support of HIBs, we were able to purchase a former nursing home facility just outside of downtown Minneapolis in the beautiful Elliott Park neighborhood. Endeavor's residents will replace our longstanding site in downtown Minneapolis, known as Exodus, and will add an additional nearly 100 deeply affordable apartments to our total number. This neighborhood is very close to amenities like transportation, social services, jobs, and healthcare, the things that our residents, just like you and me, need and value every day. Our residents are full-time renters. They sign leases with the rights and expectations of a typical market rate apartment. I want to note that it was our residents and staff who collaborated to choose the new name Endeavors that is inclusive and welcoming to individuals of all backgrounds. Life isn't always linear, and Endeavors honors each resident's journey. We were able to use HIBs to rehab this building. This was not new construction. There was no deconstruction or physical additions needed. We converted nursing home rooms into efficiency and single room occupancy apartments. We converted nursing stations into community rooms and shared kitchen spaces. And we only had to update the large commercial kitchen. We did not have to build new. We made improvements to HVAC, the roof, et cetera, the things that are often needed in a rehab. The site is large and presented a number of opportunities for us. It's important to remember that while HIBs can only be used currently for the purchase and rehabilitation for the permanent supportive housing units, that commitment from the state of Minnesota helped us to secure additional funds from Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis, as well as many generous donors, so that we could purchase the entire site and convert some of it into three very important projects. Located at this site is a 30-room recuperative care center for people experiencing homelessness who no longer need emergency room care. This relieves pressures and costs on our ERs, while providing people with a safe and dignified place to recuperate. We will also be the site for a permanent community clinic providing healthcare, psychiatric services, and more to people who meet a certain income limit. And finally, we will be bringing home all of our administrative services and our aging and disability services team. This equates to over 200 full-time jobs we are bringing to the Elliott Park neighborhood. We could not have purchased the building and added these valuable services without HIBs. It's worth noting this body approved an investment in HIBs at the end of your 2019 legislative session. Catholic Charities was awarded HIBs that November, just a few months later. We completed the funding with Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis in December and began our renovations in 2020, which is pretty fast. And while this chain of events took a lot of work and just enough luck, it was possible because of the public-private partnership that started with this body and HIBs. We reused an existing building. We are bringing 200 jobs to a new neighborhood. We are hosting innovative healthcare opportunities. And most importantly, we are providing nearly 175 truly deeply affordable apartments to Minnesotans. While we are adding a net 100 apartments to the region this spring, it is clear from the demands of our emergency shelters that the significant need for deeply affordable housing is only growing. The investment proposed here today in House File 3244 and in the bill to fund shelter capital would make a very, very real difference. I encourage you to support this bill. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Underwood. Next up, we have Director Strike from Carver County CDA. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name's Allison Strake. I'm the Deputy Director with Carver County Community Development Agency. Just give me one second, I'll get this going. Are you able to see it?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay. So again, I'm Allison Strake. I'm the Deputy Director with Carver County CDA, and I also currently serve on the board for Minnesota NARO. So on behalf of our 140 agency members, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We support this entire bill, but I will be speaking specifically to the appropriation of state general obligation bonds to preserve low-income public housing. Our members own and operate over 20,000 units of publicly owned housing, and illustrated on this map is where that housing is located across the state. These units are locally owned and managed by PHAs, HRAs, and CDAs, and their development or acquisition was paid for by the federal government. Public housing is a critical piece of the housing continuum. It provides safe and affordable homes to extremely low-income people who would otherwise lack adequate housing. Over 36,500 people are living in and paying rent on a public housing unit. The majority of the residents squeak by on $290 a week. The vast majority of households are headed by seniors and persons with disabilities. However, a third of our residents are minor children. Minnesota NARO strongly supports the provision of general obligation bonds for publicly owned housing as presented in this bill to address the unmet capital needs of these public assets valued at nearly $2 billion. But what we are facing is that 95% of our units are over 35 years old. Housing authorities rely on congressional appropriations for their capital funds, which continues to fall significantly short. In fact, nationally, the backlog of capital needs is $70 billion, and here in Minnesota, the current need is over $350 million. As you can imagine, postponing capital improvements for properties negatively affect their financial viability and affect residents' well-being. Geobond proceeds are used for health, safety, and energy efficiency improvements to these properties. This funding is awarded by Minnesota Housing in a statewide competitive award process for the publicly owned housing program, or POP. Minnesota NARO sincerely appreciates the past bipartisan support. The $61.5 million appropriated over the past 10 years has made an incredible difference to the lives of our residents and the life of these valuable assets. I would like to share with you a brief view of six of the 113 POP projects. These six examples are typical of a variety of projects funded by the POP program and matched or leveraged with public housing capital funds or other local resources. The Itasca County HRA building faced poor air quality and no way to adequately circulate and exchange air in the building. In the winter, large amounts of condensation appeared on windows and sills. The water heater was original to the building, was not energy efficient, and if it required repair, residents could be without hot water until parts could be obtained. In 2017, a POP project allowed the HRA to install an air handling system to circulate fresh air into the building, correcting the moisture and condensation issues. During the air handling project, disconnected vents were corrected in the attic spaces and insulation added. In addition, two energy efficient water heaters were installed so that if one water heater is down, residents would still have hot water. And especially important are the improvements that tenants cannot see, which keeps them safe and secure, which you see here in the pictures on the screen. In this Wilmer HRA apartment, several unrated plumbing chases were discovered, which means the enclosures for the piping had to meet current fire code and also had to be properly separated at each floor to meet code. The second example portrays the before and after of updated shower stalls, which were expanded to provide seating as well as handheld shower heads. So many of the residents that live in public housing are elderly or have a disability, so these improvements are needed and much appreciated by the residents. Virginia HRA used their dollars for fire safety and security upgrades. They have two buildings consisting of 147 units that are connected. However, the building had separate and antiquated fire alarm systems with no connection of systems between the two buildings. The fire safety upgrades included installation of a new connected fire alarm system and the replacement of fire doors and common area door hardware to meet ADA. Common area bathrooms were rehabilitated to meet ADA requirements and security cameras for residents' safety and security. The Red Wing HRA used their POP award to replace windows. These new windows meet ADA requirements, requiring less than 5 pounds operating force to open and close. And in 2017, the Red Wing HRA used POP funds to replace the two boilers and air handlers in another public housing apartment. These systems were original to the building when it was built in 1974. The St. Paul PHA made significant capital improvements to an 88-unit public housing townhomes, originally built in 1965. Despite some renovations in the 70s and 80s, the buildings were worn and did not meet modern-day codes. The POP funds were used to improve safety and security by replacing sidewalks and adding exterior lights, to improve the energy efficiency and sustainability by replacing the siding, changing the roof pitch and adding new windows, and to improve accessibility by renovating and modernizing the kitchen and bathrooms. The average cost per unit for the extensive modernization was $103,538. POP funding for Minnesota Housing helped cover construction costs and shorten the project timeline, saving years of inflation and additional general condition costs. New construction of a similar number of townhomes would have cost far more than modernizing the existing units. Overall, this modernization supported almost 135 jobs. Crossroad Construction and Minnesota Construction subcontracted a combined 13% of the contract work to Minority Business Enterprises, MBE, and 20% of the contract work to Women-Owned Business Enterprises, WBE. Many thanks to the contractors who provided building trades pre-apprenticeship opportunities for PHA residents. Although this investment has made a tremendous impact, it only represents about one third of the public housing units across the state, and I challenge us to do more. In 2019, Minnesota NARO commissioned a report to quantify the unmet critical needs in the public housing stock across the state. The immediate need is nearly $355 million. So although we have done a lot to preserve this critical asset and are making wise investments with these dollars, there is more work to be done. Not reflected in these numbers are the cost to upgrade and retrofit sprinkler systems. So if as a state we want to go down the path of keeping our public housing safe, we need the funding to do that. Steady and consistent attention is a solid, fiscally responsible way to preserve our publicly owned assets. In closing, we want to leave you with these takeaways. We know our current unmet need is $355 million, and knowing the budget constraints that must be taken into account, our request is for $100 million to maintain and effectively preserve our publicly owned assets. When we leverage the general obligation bonds with our capital fund dollars and stretch our local resources, we can bring that $355 million really close to zero and set us on a course to be able to plan for the 5 and 10 year capital improvements better. On behalf of our membership, we are grateful for your support and the opportunity to speak with you today. And Mr. Chair, we're happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Strike, for the presentation. Members, do we have any questions for Chair Hausman and her testifiers? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And if I didn't miss this, please excuse me. And I also have in my files, but it'd be easier if you just answered. Chair Hausman, what is the governor's recommendation for this? Is it 100 million or where are we?
Chair Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Birdall. I confess that I am not exactly sure. I don't know if any of the governor's staff are on to be able to answer that question, or whether the staff, whether any staff have the governor's budget in front of them.
Mr. Lee, do you have it available?
I'm guessing, but I think the HIBs were 200 million.
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm pulling up the governor's budget right now. The MHFA public housing request from the governor's was 60 million in GO bonds, and the housing infrastructure bond request was 250 million in appropriation bonds.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to know what that was. Housing is important. We need to consider it strongly. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, Chair Hausman, any closing comments?
To say thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your attention to this issue. The need is so urgent. I just bring with me all of the energy from the Homes for All supporters, organizations, and advocates around the state who are working very hard to make this case to the citizens of Minnesota and to the legislature. So we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Chair Hausman, for bringing this to our attention. Next up on the agenda is Chair Gomez, House File 3090. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Lee and Leader Erdahl, or Vice Chair Murphy and Leader Erdahl and members of the committee. I'm just gonna share my screen quick.
Chair Gomez, I understand that you also have an amendment coded the A1-1. Can you explain that too when you go through your presentation? Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So House File 3090 is an appropriation for shelter capital. The amount in 3090 is $75 million, which is a one-time cash appropriation. The A1 amendment, the main thing that it does is it increases the appropriation from $75 million to $100 million. My testifier will kind of go into what we base those numbers on, but the reason for the change is because, you know, we've kind of been talking about this bill. It's really the centerpiece of our homelessness response proposal for this year. And we base the numbers on an evaluation of need across the state. And so the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless was able to kind of update that need evaluation, which is why the amount, the request has increased and the A1. So that's that. As I said, it's a one-time cash appropriation. It would address a number of needs in emergency shelter for both individuals and families. You know, across the state of Minnesota, every 3 years, the Wilder Foundation leads what's called a point in time count. It's sort of hard to get your arms around the scope of homelessness in general, right? Because it looks different in different parts of the state. And, you know, some people are sleeping outside. Some people are sleeping in their cars. Some people are doubled up with other families. There's a really wide array. Some are staying in shelter. It's a wide array of sort of responses that families and individuals have to homelessness. But you know, we do this once a year count, and they kind of do a projection out from there. It was supposed to happen in 2021, the latest kind of count, which is completed across the state by volunteers. And it got pushed back a year for COVID. So our data is a little bit old, but we do know that, you know, in 2018, there were almost 20,000 people each night in Minnesota experiencing homelessness, and that over the course of a year, about 50,000 Minnesotans experience homelessness. And there's been, you know, there's sort of some trends. There's been a major increase in unsheltered homelessness, which those of us who live in the metro will see, you know, kind of a growth of encampments that are really visible to the community and present a number of issues for the folks who are staying there as well as the surrounding areas. Also, there are more and more families with young children who are experiencing homelessness. And we know that, you know, if you don't have a safe place to lay your head at night, it's hard to do anything. It's hard to get to school. It's hard to, you know, to achieve academically. And so, you know, this issue of homelessness and housing instability is really related to the opportunity gap experienced by our students in schools and has a lot of kind of rippling impacts. There are also a lot of young adults, 16 to 24, who are not living with their families who are experiencing homelessness. And those young people are really, they're really at risk of sexual exploitation, various kinds of violence in their communities. And homelessness disproportionately impacts Minnesota residents of color, especially Black and Indigenous Minnesotans who experience homelessness, you know, at a rate many times their population. And so if you look, I popped up this little map. And so those are the lines are the counties. And as you can see, if you sort of look in the middle, in the metro, in Hennepin, we have 28 emergency shelters. And this is not perfect, right? Because it doesn't have like the number of beds. It doesn't have a lot of specificity. But once you get outside of the metro and, you know, St. Louis County, which is the one that has 17 shelters that's up north, especially if you look in southern Minnesota, I mean, there are counties where there's no homelessness response whatsoever or no emergency shelter whatsoever. And so what that means is that if you live in many parts of the state and you or your family experiences, you know, needs to access emergency shelter, a lot of times people are leaving their home communities. So they're uprooting their students from their kids from school. They're leaving their families. They're leaving their social networks. They're leaving, you know, their faith communities. They're leaving all the sort of social supports that make that kind of informally that make life work for folks. And a lot of times coming to the metro or to St. Louis County, if they live in northern Minnesota, because that's the only place that they can access shelter. And it's much more difficult in a lot of cases to, you know, to stabilize in the absence of those networks and relationships. So basically, we have this situation where outside of the metro, we don't have a lot of shelter. Shelter providers are doing their work with like little to no room in their budgets. And so we have a real opportunity this year to make a huge dent in this issue. And so that's why we're asking for such a kind of high number as an investment in this issue. You'll hear from my testifiers that, you know, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness both convene shelter providers regularly. And the number one thing that they say is they need help with capital. It's the piece that's the hardest. You know, there are various public sources for operations, but capital is just really, really hard to come by. And so if we don't do an infusion, then we're going to kind of continue to see this regional disparity and the kind of, you know, issues around deferred maintenance, people doing activities in like spaces that weren't meant for them. Like, you know, we'll hear about like, you know, just general like leaky roofs, people sleeping in gymnasiums, you know, so this really will allow shelter providers to make investments in, you know, building new shelter, in addressing deferred maintenance, including life safety issues, mechanical HVAC systems, rehab and renovation of existing shelter, and will really just, you know, kind of get us to a point where we can help out those folks who are just really in an emergency and need a little bit of help to get back on their feet. And, you know, before I turn it over to the testifiers, I just wanted to say, you know, I know that you guys have a lot of intersection in capital investment with housing, but, you know, housing is a continuum. And so everything from home ownership to rental to public housing to shelter exists on this continuum. And, you know, our advocates have a saying, and it's housing ends homelessness and shelter saves lives. And so Chair Hausman brought you the real solution, right? Which is we need more housing that's more affordable to more people. And we need to robustly invest in our public infrastructure of housing, which is public housing. But this is the part that's gonna save people's lives. And so, you know, so I'm really thankful to you for hearing this bill today. And I hope that your members will consider supporting it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. First up is Rhonda Otteson. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, Chair Lee and members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Otteson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. With over 70 member organizations across the state, we work to generate policies, community support, and local resources for housing and services to end homelessness in Minnesota. I'm here to support House File 3090, which would make a significant investment in the development, acquisition, and rehabilitation of shelter beds across the state, creating safe indoor spaces for individuals and families sleeping outside or staying in unsafe conditions. In fact, 80 of 87 counties lack enough shelter beds to meet the need. Investing into shelter is an equity issue, as Chair Gomez noted. Black, Indigenous, and people of color experience homelessness at much higher rates than the white population. This investment will allow for the development of culturally appropriate and low barrier shelters that are essential to advancing housing stability in communities of color and across the state. Over the past 2 years, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless has worked closely with our community partners and leaders all across the state to identify the need for expanded shelter and preserving the shelters we already have. And we're constantly learning of new projects, searching for the needed capital resources. I'd like to call your attention to the document in your packet called Statewide Emergency Shelter Needs Assessment, and it is also on your screen. As noted, there are 51 projects ready to be funded with a funding gap of almost $100 million. One important nuance to note is that there are 10 projects that don't have a defined cost, so the $100 million is a very close estimate. Overall, these investments would create or preserve 2,013 shelter beds. 827 new beds would be created and 1,186 beds would be preserved. There are a wide range of shelter projects on this assessment, and those are the types that are needed are culturally specific, domestic violence shelters, youth shelters, and others as noted. For many shelters that have never had access to county or state funding, they are seeking to address the deferred maintenance, a roof, plumbing, updating accessibility for people with mobility challenges or sensory needs, transforming spaces to make them more resilient to a pandemic, and creating spaces that are private for families and guests. We know that shelter saves lives and housing ends homelessness. With over 20,000 Minnesotans experiencing homelessness on any given night, now is the time to make the long overdue investments into our shelter system. Until we have enough quality homes for children, adults, and seniors in our state, shelter is a critical piece of the housing continuum. Thank you for your time, and I and my colleagues are available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Otteson, for that detailed breakdown. Next up, we have Rose Surma. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Committee Chair Lee and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Rose Surma, and I'm the executive director for the nonprofit organization Oasis Central Minnesota. We provide emergency shelter and housing case management for both families and individuals in Morrison County. Our agency is supported by Minnesota DHS OEO grant funds, foundation grants, and donation support from our community. Currently, our organization is the only emergency shelter provider in the county, as well as much of the surrounding counties. Additionally, there is no women's shelter located in our county, so we are often providing shelter for those fleeing family violence. In fact, around 50% of those we serve are families with minor children. Our agency currently provides shelter in a motel setting as well as in a rented duplex. While the motel setting has provided an immediate and flexible option, there are challenges to both the setting. If you can imagine a family of with children spending up to 90 days in a motel room, challenges with private space, food preparation and storage, as well as the cost efficiency. There's also challenges with the motel, including vacancy issues at times. Our duplex has the focus of providing shelter for families and is more efficient than the motel. However, the need is greater than our current resources. For example, at this time, we do not have space that's accessible for those with mobility challenges. Neither the motel nor the duplex is handicap accessible. When we work with households that have a need for a handicap accessible shelter, we are having to try to find space outside of our community, which has transportation issues, availability issues, as well as asking households to leave their community. We need funding that will allow us to purchase property to meet the needs of our community and make improvements for accessibility. Acquisition of additional property would allow us to increase our service capacity and better serve those needing shelter in our community. I hope you will join me in supporting shelter capital funding through House File 3090. This is a critical investment toward ending homelessness in Minnesota. Thank you for your time, and I am available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Surma. Next up, we have Angela Larson. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Representative Lee and members. My name is Angela Larson, and I'm the Family Services Director for United Community Action Partnership, or UCAP. I work primarily in Marshall, which is in Lyon County, but we serve 13 counties for emergency shelter and emergency housing. I'm very pleased to provide testimony regarding the needs of shelter capital in rural Minnesota today. As the main provider of homelessness and emergency housing in Southwest Minnesota, UCAP serves people with homeless prevention, shelter, and ongoing supportive housing programs. Since we have no traditional homeless shelters in our region, UCAP, like many rural agencies, had to be creative in our homelessness response. So over the years, we have and currently operate models using a motel voucher model, providing just a couple of nights, or a leased motel unit or apartment model. We've also been very fortunate to have community partners who have come together to make these models and others work. However, it can be difficult to operate these programs without a long-term assurance that the model and or the capacity will be available in the future. The need for shelter continues to grow, and once people are in shelter, it's been taking people longer to get them to be able to exit. There is a lack of affordable housing, income-based units are scarce, and many people experiencing homelessness have barriers like poor credit. And since the eviction moratorium, many landlords are being more selective with their application processes and requiring double, triple deposits to enter housing. With COVID-19 relief dollars running out in the next year, we face a reduction in the ability to prevent homelessness as well. So if people experiencing homelessness can't get into housing and we don't have enough funds to help people avoid eviction, that means we'll have more people in shelter. Already in the last year, our shelter utilization has more than doubled. Rural shelter options are few and far between, so shelter capital is a critical need for rural Minnesota. Currently, we're hoping to fund projects to help fix up some units at a local motel to make them safer and more family friendly. This would preserve our ability to provide safe, low barrier shelter in Kaneohe County, for example, which is an area of great need. And this would preserve that for years. Having the option to purchase and renovate rather than lease space for shelter is a longer term solution to a lasting problem. Another example is in Meeker County. There, we hope to purchase a fourplex apartment building and use those units to provide shelter to families. This is a model that has been utilized, but the building has come up for sale and those units could become unavailable to us in the very near future. The building does need some renovations, but has an amazing location that is less than two blocks from our offices, other supportive services, grocery stores, employment opportunities, and more. And we already have an established local partner that is willing to assist with ongoing operation costs like utilities, snow removal, et cetera. So this acquisition and rehab would be very cost effective moving forward. We believe this model would be very replicable in other counties as well. With our various shelter units throughout our service area consistently full, it's important for UCAP and other agencies to identify long-term options to provide shelter units in our rural areas. Our amazing staff do a great job providing the services, so once sheltered, people have a lot of support. One example is Cheryl, who identifies as having lived experience of homelessness. She's on our staff. She has dedicated her career to help those who struggle with being homeless. She's driven to be able to serve the community and make a difference and be the voice of those who are or have experienced homelessness. Thank you for providing the time to be able to share the housing needs in our rural area. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Next up, we have Nikki Mabry. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Chairlee.
Mr. Acton.
Hi, Chairlee. My name is Zach Acton. I'm Director of Public Policy with Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. I just got an alert from Nikki that their internet is having some difficulties. They're trying to reconnect, but in the meantime, might be good to move on to question time.
Thank you, Mr. Acton. Members, do we have any questions for Chair Gomez or her testifiers? All right, seeing none, Mr. Acton, is Nikki back on? If not, then we'll go to closing comments from Chair Gomez.
I don't believe that Nikki is back on, but thanks. We appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Acton. Chair Gomez, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, so like the reason that I became the chair of the Homelessness Committee is because in 2020, after George Floyd was killed in my district, there was a, an encampment behind the Target right by the third precinct that caught on fire. And so people from that encampment moved down to a park in my district. So there was in the summer of 2020, a homeless encampment with 200 to 400 people in my neighborhood park. And it was really interesting to me because I hadn't had the experience of like being in that kind of space before. And I spent a lot of time there. After we ended our special session, I was there most nights and got to talk to a lot of the folks who live there. And it was interesting because there were people there who had such a wide variety of reasons for not accessing even the shelter that was available. And so one of our testifiers talked about this sort of new model of shelter. It's like more and more this really huge kind of institutional congregate shelter idea that we have, like of people kind of sleeping in cots in a gym, is we're really realizing is not meeting people's needs. And so, you know, I think that this infusion of capital really provides an opportunity for us to develop the shelter that meets people's needs and meets people where they are. Shelter that is low barrier, that's service rich, that respects and understands the, you know, the social connections that are built sometimes, or the need for like to find a place to put people's stuff or to find a place to put people's pets. It's really, you know, we're really asking you today to respond boldly to this crisis of homelessness and housing instability using bonding dollars. You know, I know that there's a lot of proposals that you guys hear here, but I hope that you will consider kind of in this moment when we have a little bit of extra cash kicking around our state based on the press conference I saw yesterday, to meet this moment and to really try to make moves to meet the needs of Minnesotans across the state who are experiencing housing instability or homelessness. And thank you so much for your time, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and your testifiers for bringing the need up for us to consider as we look at the housing crisis that we have in the state. Next up, we have Chair Eklund, House File 2934. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Murphy, Leader Erdahl, and committee members. Thank you for taking time today to hear House File 2934, a bonding request from the City of International Falls, which is a border community in my district and the place that I call home. For several years now, the City of International Falls has undertaken a comprehensive master plan study to determine the best use of current park facilities and what improvements might be needed to enhance or develop a facility to best serve the citizens of both International Falls and the surrounding communities. International Falls Cary Park Health and Wellness Center plan in front of you today is a culmination of that planning. The Wellness Center would be a regional health, wellness, sports, and recreation center, as well as an emergency shelter, daycare, and more. Here today is Mayor Harley Droba, who will tell the committee about the city's plan to develop this exciting new facility.
Mr. Mayor, please identify yourself and proceed.
Committee Chair Lee, Vice Chair Murphy, Representative Erdahl, and members of the Capital Investment Committee. For the record, I am International Falls Mayor Harley M. Droba, representing House File 2934. On behalf of the residents of the City of International Falls and the surrounding area, thank you for taking the time to hear our project today. We've been working for years to satisfy the diverse needs of northern Minnesota. I am pleased to present the Cary Park Health and Wellness Center, a project that will be a multi-generational youth facility, allowing us to tackle our daycare shortages, a place for our senior citizens to gather, amongst a host of other features that are important to the community. The Cary Park Health and Wellness Center will allow us to enhance the services that have always been at Cary Park in the past. Historically, it has been functional in the case of an emergency, while the day-to-day operations have been recreational in nature. This facility would be utilized as a staging point for the International Falls Emergency Services in the event of an evacuation of City Hall. Currently, we do not have a secondary location that would fit that need, which was highlighted over the last 2 years during the pandemic. International Falls Emergency Services cover 192 square miles of rural Minnesota, while our city is only 6.2 square miles. Cary Park Health and Wellness Center will provide a staging area for sandbagging during high waters of Rainy River and Rainy Lake, amongst other crisis-based needs. The recreation component of this project is really simple to show on paper. However, the bigger picture is larger than the playground, splash park, skating area, or for that matter, the gym, the community room, hockey arena, and sledding hill. And for everyone's information, International Falls, Icebox of the Nation, does not have a sledding hill. In your handouts, you can see everything that I just mentioned with an entire rendering. As you look over them, I would like to tell you the big picture of the Cary Park project as, you know, the community sees it. Highway 53 for years has been a one-way highway. Our sports teams have traveled for weekend tournaments on the Iron Range, Duluth, and the metro area. However, the lack of hotels in International Falls, we haven't been able to host many. Again, it's a one-way highway. Our high school graduates, those that were raised in loving families with skilled parents and financial means, have went off to college. They have moved to communities where they can garnish higher pay, fun attractions, and a better way of life than what our community can offer. It's a one-way highway. 3 years ago, when this project was in its infancy, the vision was to bring those parents that are now in their 50s and 60s, 70s, that raised their children so well, to give them an opportunity to meet, help, and interact with the children of the community. We investigated a daycare senior matchup to help those children that need a mentor and the seniors that need someone to carry on their knowledge and work ethic in our community. This was all in an effort to keep some of our youth from taking that one-way highway. Coincidentally, something else happened in the last 3 years that we've been working on this project. The state of Minnesota started the Highway 53 reconstruction project. This project has been so beneficial to us. Words cannot express how thankful we are. It has spurred three private investments in our community. Two of those were $10 million, 80-plus room hotels and a new $1 million gas station. I tell you this because we have the opportunity right now, starting in 2023, to again draw those guests into our community. International Falls Icebox of the Nation could again host hockey, basketball, volleyball, bowling, and a host of other tournaments, stopping that one-way highway. We feel that we must complement the investments to our hotel stock into this facility and draw an economic boost to the area. I personally would like to thank Representative Eklund for submitting this bill. Please support our request for a two-way highway of 53. Please support House File 2934, funding the International Falls Cary Park Health and Wellness Center. I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mayor Droba. Members, do we have any questions for Chair Eklund or the mayor? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, is there a funding match that Mr. Mayor, you are offering for this?
Mayor Drobo.
Committee Chair Lee and members of the committee, Representative Erdahl, we definitely do have some monies that have been set aside for this. The city has been able to fund, can fund the project $1.1 million through our city sales tax infrastructure and a private investment from our local Rotary Club and others. Also, we have hired a firm to verify that we're in good financial shape to operate and maintain this for generations in the future.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted that information.
Chair Murphy, I saw your hand.
Yes, you did, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mayor, you're talking about a two-way highway, but that's just words. Is that correct? The money is for the park and the recreation area and the building for that, not for building a highway.
Mayor Drobo.
Representative, or Committee Chair Lee and members of the community or committee, Representative Murphy, I agree 100%. That is just in context. It's the way we've looked at this project is we have so many things that happen in our community that draw people out of our area. This is not to fund a highway. This is to fund a facility to bring economic development into our area to bring people to International Falls rather than all the events in northern Minnesota being outside of our area.
Chair Murphy.
Thank you for that clarification.
Seeing no other questions, closing comments, Chair Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I coached hockey for 17 years before I got involved in public service, and I did that, and I've been involved in that for 12 years. So Cary Park needs a rebuild. I appreciate the committee's time hearing this bill, and it'll be a welcome development to our community.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mayor, for coming by. Next up, we have Representative Erdahl, House File 2789. Please proceed. Representative Erdahl, are you available? Okay.
Right, and I'm here now. Just 1 second. I've got two Zoom going at the same time. And I need to turn down the sound.
Melody Benjamin on this here.
Sorry about this. This is what I was afraid would happen.
Rebecca Crook Stratton is here.
All right, here we go. Sorry. Mr. Chair, are you ready for me to go here?
Yep, please proceed. House File 2789.
Okay. Thank you. Camp Courage has a long history of providing for camping and recreational needs for disabled children and adults and their families. It also has team development sessions. I have attended there with colleagues from New London Spicer when I was teaching there for a team building session. But a new welcome and recreation center is badly needed. I've toured, I've seen the facility, and it does need help. And I think that most of the story should be told by testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. First up, we have John LeBlanc. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Representative Erdahl. My name is John LeBlanc. I'm the president of True Friends. And thank you all for considering this great project. Joining me today are three adults, Kari, Pete, and Johnny, who happen to use wheelchairs. Pete has used a chair since birth. Kari and Johnny acquired their physical disability later in life. True Friends is a collection of four camp locations throughout Minnesota, providing these outdoor vacation experiences for people with all types of abilities and chronic medical conditions. In addition to all the programs our staff provide, we partner with many organizations to broaden our mission. Some of these partners include Camp Cambria, serving kids with juvenile arthritis, Camp Sweet Life, serving kids with juvenile diabetes, and the United States Power Soccer Association, and so many more. Minnesotans and the people who have come before us truly have something to be proud of. I have searched far and wide, and I have not been able to find another camping organization anywhere that provides this broad range of services to as many throughout the entire year as True Friends does. The current project is building a new pool, gym, and welcome center at Camp Courage. The existing facilities are over 50 years old and failing. While we have an impressive fundraising capacity, we know that state support is essential to bringing this project to fruition. We have never undertaken this ambitious of a capital fundraising campaign, and this is our first time we are pursuing public funding. While the tangible project is a recreation and welcome center, all that we do results in building independence, confidence, and courage. It's about people, through no fault of their own, having extra challenges, and we provide an opportunity to feel normal. As I close, I want to draw your attention to a story in your packets about Kari that you can read at another time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. LeBlanc. Next up, we have Kari Neshe. Apologize if I have your last name wrong. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, I'm Kari Neshe. I live in Alden, which is down in Freeborn County. I became a quad amputee 5 years ago. I have been going to Camp Courage for 3 years now. And to me, I love going there. It gives me a sense of being independent, makes me feel normal again from being able to go out on a boat, go fishing, go hike, you know, go out on trails and stuff. And I think it's important to improve the pool and the gymnasium and welcome center. I think they'd have be able to do more activities with an updated area. That's it.
Thank you, Ms. Nesty. Next up, we have Pete Winslow. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for having me this morning. Like I said, I'm Pete Winslow. I've been a camper at True Friends for a long time for the Power Soccer Camp, and most recently for the last 7 or 8 years. I'm one of three people that helped lead and organize the camp. And so I've seen a lot. And I think that one of the stories that stands out to me that True Friends provides is just the transformation that our campers go through, our power soccer athletes, because I remember seeing a little girl, she's probably 9 or 10, sitting on the sideline before she was playing. And I went over to her and she wasn't talking to very many people. And you know, we immediately hit it off, and I could see her slowly coming out of her shell, as we made that connection. And then as soon as she hit the court, it was incredible to see just the different side of her that came out. You know, she was giving orders like a general out there to her teammates. She was a firecracker. It was incredible. And just to see that she could be, you know, comfortable, coming out of her shell and, you know, being part of the power soccer community. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. And so if that's something that we can have a hand in, I consider, you know, job well done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Winslow. Next up, we have Johnny Lane. Please identify yourself and proceed. Mr. Lane, you're on mute right now.
My apologies. As I said before, my name is Jonathan Lang. I have been a wheelchair user since I was about 8 years old, and going through my everyday life with the challenges that I faced was not easy, but I had to overcome them, as many of us have had to do in our lives. And I have been involved with True Friends and Camp Courage for 5 years. I started there when I was in 2017 as a camp counselor, as an activities counselor. And my first impressions, I mean, I was amazed. I was absolutely amazed. This camp and these people really truly care about helping others and giving back. And as a wheelchair user, all you want to ever do is be able to give back to your community and give back to the people that, you know, the everyday live people that help you out so much. You want to be able to give back to them. That's at least what it is for me. I want to give back to the people that I can help. And Camp Courage and True Friends gave me that possibility. I was able to have freedom. I was able to, you know, express myself in ways that I wasn't able to express before. I was able to, you know, growing up with a disability, I was able to provide my life and give back to those in need, serving the people at this camp. And, you know, True Friends is, I mean, it speaks for itself. The name speaks for itself. I mean, True Friends, you go there, you go experience this camp, and these people are your friends. These people welcome you in. These people are they're amazing. They've done things in their lives that I haven't even done before. And, you know, the experience that we can all come together and cherish. I mean, it's one big family, one big community, and it's life changing. And I am so grateful for the opportunity that I've had to be able to be there for 5 summers, serving these people in this community in the capacity of working there. And I am just forever grateful because True Friends has changed my life in ways that I cannot describe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. First up for questions, Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would just like to thank Chair Erdahl for bringing this bill forward. This is a very important bill, and I hope this committee will give it full consideration. There's a long history of these groups in our state, whether it be Camp Courage or the others that are involved here. And I really hope members can support the provisions here from Representative Erdahl. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Next up, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to recognize Carrie there in Alden. I grew up in Freeborn, which was the birthplace of corn drives for Camp Courage. And we're going to need a little more than corn to help out with the facilities. So I know that still goes on, but I remember doing that, and hope we can help out.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Seeing no other members' question, Representative Erdahl, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to conclude by saying that this is a very important place. It's a very important project that we need to give strong consideration to. You know, Camp Courage is not just a name. It's not just a place. It's a culture. And we need to, again, take a real good look at helping out the needs that they have. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. And thank you to all the testifiers for sharing your story, too. Really appreciate that. Next up, Representative Erdahl, we have a draft code CG-124-3. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This project will build 5 single-family homes in Meeker County, 3 in Litchfield and 2 in Eden Valley. The United Community Action Partnership was awarded $399,644 in grant funding and $450,000 in construction loan financing. But they need $375,000. That's the difference between what the project will cost and the funding that they now have available. And this cost is a result of prevailing wage requirements. I'm not trying to change prevailing wage here. I'm just trying to cover its cost in this particular bill. And this is a nonprofit, so it would require cash. So I appreciate your attention to this. And I do have Jeff Gladys from UCAP, who is a testifier for me.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. So first up, we have Jeff Gladys. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak this morning. I am Jeff Gladys. I am the housing director at United Community Action Partnership. And we are, as Angela stated a little earlier, we're an agency that our main service area is 9 counties in southwest to central Minnesota, but we also assist other agencies in their service areas. So like in housing, we are working pretty strongly in 13 counties in Minnesota. And what we're looking to do here is that many of our local rural communities are struggling with trying to add affordable housing. We are the ability to add single family housing in smaller communities right now is extremely difficult due to the cost of building and the cost that it costs to build versus what you could sell that property for really is hard for developers unless you're in a little larger community and so forth. And so one of the things that, we do is we work with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to try to build single family housing in our rural area. And they help us cover some of the gap financing that it takes to build these. And I have to say that I work with, other programs besides Minnesota Housing in, our service area. And when I go meet with, these communities in our service area, every one of them brings up, is there any way you can bring affordable housing? It doesn't matter if it's a community of 750 people or 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000. The communities that we're talking about, I just looked very quickly this morning. Eden Valley is approximately 1,000 people, and there isn't a house for sale in Eden Valley right now. I looked in Litchfield, a community that's in over 6,000 people, and they have 7 houses for sale in the whole community. And this is a common theme in our entire rural area. I'm working on grants for small cities development projects and communities. I'm just working on one right now for that gives you another example. Jackson, a community of, 4,000 people, has 1 house for sale. So what we are trying to do is just do whatever we can to, build houses in these communities. And basically what has happened with this project is we had started some single family housing in Lyon County in the community of Marshall, and it was rolling around along very successfully. And the prevailing wage rate was difficult, but we were making it work. And we were able to build, I think we're at in the process of putting up houses 12 and 13 there right now out of a total of 16. But when COVID hit and the prevailing wages in Meeker County hit, it just threw a stop into single family construction for these smaller communities that need the gap financing. And basically what we saw in Meeker County was there were no prevailing wage rates for that county. So they took neighboring counties that had higher wage rates due to more metro areas and applied them to our project. And what that did is it's with the change in material prices and the due to COVID and combine that with prevailing wage, it just stopped us dead in our tracks. There's no way we can build these 5 houses right now. And basically we're just looking to add any type of housing that we can in these communities. I thank you for considering this, and we'll try to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gladys. Representative Erdahl, do you have another testifier, or is that just Mr. Gladys?
I think that's my only testifier.
Okay. Members, any questions for Representative Erdahl or his testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Erdahl, any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the leeway a little bit this morning. Sorry about having another meeting at the same time, but that's the way it goes. This is very, very important. Housing in greater Minnesota, housing across the state, as Representative Hausman pointed out, is a big issue. And we need every housing project we can get. As Mr. Gladys pointed out, if you want to buy a house in Litchfield or Eden Valley or throughout my district, there just aren't places for sale. And there are companies that want to expand. They have no place for their people to live. And so this is just a small step, but an important one to addressing that need. So again, thank you for your consideration, and thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Next up, we have Chair Lilly, House File 3191. Please proceed, Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and committee members. Good morning. So this morning, I'm bringing the project for Harriet Tubman Center, a renovation project for those folks that haven't been around for a while. Tubman is a nonprofit organization that provides services to folks, nearly 25,000 people every year that are experiencing relationship violence, sexual assault, exploitation, homelessness, addiction, mental health challenges, and other forms of trauma. So just so you know, about 65% of the folks that they're serving are BIPOC, and like we heard on the homeless issue this all through this morning here, you know, 37% of the services are provided, you know, for children. But so this project that we have with you today is for renovation, you know, for safety changes and improvements to the building, efficiencies, some of the things to meet those sort of things. And then kind of the world, you know, it was mentioned in the homeless thing, some of the, you know, nearly half the folks that are coming in won't leave a bad situation because of pets or something like that. So they're trying to figure that out. But this morning, I'm super excited to have the CEO, Ms. Polzin, with me, and she can kind of dig in deeper to what we're trying to do here. Tubman's been a recipient of a bonding in the past and just been a great steward of the money. And unfortunately, we weren't able to get a stop. This bill came in a little bit later, but it's been, they've been great stewards. And Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'd like to pass it to the Ms. Polzin.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. Jennifer Polzin, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Lee, Vice Chair Murphy, Lead Erdahl, and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Lilly. I'm Jennifer Polzin, the CEO of Tubman, and I appreciate this opportunity to share more about our request for capital investment funds in the amount of $5,965,000, as outlined in House File 3191, and the information in your packets. As Representative Lilly shared, every year we serve about 25,000 people. It's all ages, genders, cultural backgrounds, and it's a full array of services for people who have experienced trauma, particularly relationship violence, sex trafficking, homelessness, mental and chemical health issues. Our services include a 24/7 low barrier, service-rich domestic violence emergency shelter, with private bedrooms and lots of services that are all survivor specific, an on-site transitional housing program for youth who've experienced trafficking and violence, helping people find and maintain their housing in the community, a variety of legal services, mental health therapy, substance abuse treatment, violence prevention education, youth diversion services and outreach, jobs education and economic advancement services, and more. All Tubman programs are designed with, by, and for survivors who are Black, Indigenous, or other people of color using a racial equity lens. And the public benefits of this project are certainly community safety, first and foremost, shelter, housing, and economic security. Harriet Tubman Center East is a 57-year-old, 110,000 square foot historically significant building that we own and operate in Maplewood, and we thank you for your previous support and bonding. To expand programs to serve a growing number of clients, especially through the challenges that our communities have faced these past several years, we have to invest in additional capital improvements. Those improvements include the addition of a public elevator to assure universal accessibility to program services for people with disabilities, as well as safety and confidentiality for all facility users, particularly those who are survivors living in our on-site shelter and housing programs. It's some life safety things, including the completion of some fire sprinkling, partial roof replacement, electrical upgrades and energy efficiency improvements, replacement of windows in the shelter and housing wing for both improved safety and increased ventilation, which has become especially important as a COVID mitigation strategy. It does include the construction of an on-site pet shelter. As you heard referenced, nearly half of domestic violence survivors delay leaving an abusive situation because of concern for their pet safety. And also a commercial kitchen. There's a 12,000 square foot former commercial kitchen on site. We are undergoing a feasibility study to determine the best way to transform that space into an enterprise opportunity that could include either partnership with an organization using our asset to deliver on their mission of addressing food insecurity, or a job development and training opportunity for small businesses and entrepreneurs, particularly survivors, as they launch their businesses. It's really important to point out that domestic violence affects 1 in 3 women and 1 in 6 men. And you may not know that 75% of victims are under age 24. Two-thirds of homeless families are homeless because of domestic violence. And the National Network to End Domestic Violence reports that 99% of survivors have experienced economic abuse, which limits their ability to secure and maintain their housing and makes them more likely to fall into a cycle of reliance on public benefits and low-wage work. We know about the disproportionality of who is affected. And so it is for all of those reasons why this work is so central to our mission. It's also really important to me to point out that this is a public-private partnership, and that many victims, survivors of domestic violence and exploitation need to stay in their local communities to be close to their jobs, their schools, their support systems, but others have no choice but to relocate because the danger is so great. So I'm pleased to be here today with our coalitions and other community partners. And I thank you for your time and consideration. Pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Polson. Members, do we have any questions for Chair Lilly or his testifier? Seeing none, Chair Lilly, any closing comments?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just hope that you were able to hear the discussion today and about this project. It's really, you know, quite shocking when you think of, you know, 25,000 people served and the work that they're doing. You know, that's annually. I mean, just constantly going on. You know, we just, you know, a lot of us don't see this every day unless it, you know, is a part of your story. But this place is really magical, and I'd like to get you over there and other committee members, you know, if we could, like a day visit or something. But it's quite magical where the nuns, it's a historic building. It was a convent, and they donated, I think, the building to Tubman and continue to work with the folks at Tubman. And they set up a place next door for them, a newer building, but they continue to work with Tubman. But it's just there's literally like a magic that's going on helping people that are really in high need. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lilly and Ms. Posen, for coming by. Next on the agenda is the last bill. We have Chair Stevenson, House File 2763. Chair Stevenson, I understand that there's an unspecified appropriations for the proposal. Sure, if you want to cover that in your remarks, that would be great. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I lost you for a second there. Can you hear me?
We can hear you now. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Murphy, Leader L, members of the committee. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to talk to you today about this project, which is very close to my heart. And I was been listening in to the hearing for most of the morning, and I've been really struck by the focus on homelessness and really glad and housing issues, and really glad to follow in particular Leader Earl's bill with regard to housing problems in rural Minnesota, because I think a lot of times we think about homelessness and housing problems as relating to urban populations, but the truth is they affect the entire state. And the bill that we are looking at in committee today relates to homeless youth in a suburban community in Anoka County, and specifically allocating $8 million to help a wonderful not-for-profit named Hope for Youth build a youth drop-in center in Anoka County. Hope for Youth is the only not-for-profit serving homeless youth in Anoka County. And I think in part that's because the problem of homelessness in suburban communities, particularly among young people, is largely invisible to the average person. Homelessness in suburban communities looks different. It's harder to see, and particularly when you have young people. But I've lived in a suburban community my whole life. And when I look back, now that I know what I'm looking for, I can kind of see signs all around me. And I was talking to some teachers about this issue a while ago, And they said, you know, we know the kids that don't have a place to sleep and a place to go. And we can see that. And I know that there are a lot of educators and former educators on this committee. And I'm guessing that if they think back to the students that they've worked with over the years, they can probably think of a few that were probably experiencing this. And Hope for Youth is a not-for-profit that has tremendous community support in Anoka County. They do great work, and they're just bursting at the seams in their current facility, and they need more space and more resources to serve kids who don't have a place to go. Mr. Chair, I do have the executive director of Hope for Youth with me. I think we were trying to have a youth come today. I'm not sure if they're on the Zoom, but hopefully they are. But I'd first ask if you could recognize the executive director of Hope for Youth.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. First up, we have LaShelle Williams. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We are honored to be here. My name is LaShelle Williams, and I'm the Executive Director of Hope for Youth. And I will be representing the file number 2763. And if I could bring up my screen. And as we heard from Representative Gomez earlier today, homelessness is real, and youth homelessness incorporates about 13,000 young people that have found themselves unhoused. And we are here to serve those young people and help them in ways that they otherwise could not be met. Representative Stevenson shared a little bit about our organization. Our mission was started 13 years ago to provide pathways ending youth homelessness. And our vision is that every youth that walks through our facility feels safe, valued, and supported while we are providing basic needs and then tools for them to thrive. Our strategic priorities are clear. We operate out of two facilities. Today, we're talking about our drop-in center. Last year, we focused on building that welcoming, trusted environment. And because of the work and the effort that was done, the youth, their visits to our facility increased by 45%. We served 314 unique youth nearly 2,500 times throughout the year. They came to us hungry. They came to us needing support. They came to us fearful. And whether we provided meals or provided them diapers for their little ones, they had the opportunity to take a shower, maybe do a load of laundry or go upstairs to our clothing closet to find an outfit to wear for an upcoming interview. We had mentors that came in and spent time with our young people, encouraging, helping them to believe in their potential when the rest of the world and maybe their family said otherwise. Our demographics are broad. We make sure that we create an inclusive, supportive environment, and we believe in case management. That is where we build the trusted engagement with our young people to guide them, direct them to the services that they need outside of the basic needs. And those would be potentially working on their mental health challenge. It might be a chemical dependency issue. It might be recovering from trauma with abuse. Whatever it is, we're here for our young people. We approach our work with our young people in a fourfold approach, walking alongside them with harm reduction, a client or youth-centered philosophy, strength-based mindset, and then always trauma-informed care. Now, we're making progress, committee, and we are absolutely moving the needle. We feel honored and proud to come beside our youth in the way that we've been able to, but we are literally busting at the seams in our rental facility. We currently are doing the work that we're doing with these young people in a 6,000 square foot space, but we're not able to take on and support the youth in the way that we know that we need to. A new facility, a new center would allow us to provide those ongoing basic needs and support. It would allow us to ensure that they have stable housing and understand how to retain and maintain that housing. We want to be here for continued employment, vocational or educational support. And knowing that the work that we do in the providing of those basic needs will often open up issues that are interconnected for our youth, but will not surface until they have a trusted environment by which they can work through it. We want to make sure that we build and expand our health, well-being, social, and emotional offerings to our young people. And again, have them work with the referrals. We are connected with our community partners, and if it's mental health support, if it's mental or physical support, if it is even dental needs, we want to be that provider that will help them. Our goal is definitely to build and empower our youth to be contributors to our community. And we know that through our work, we can change that trajectory and they can be living self-sustaining lives. Now, our conversation, it is about a new facility, but I'll share with you, it is so, so much more than the bricks and mortar. It is truly allowing us to open our doors, serve more youth, and provide the services that they need to thrive and be strong community members. And with that, I want to thank you again, Mr. Chairman, and the committee, and I will turn it over then as appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. So we only have 4 minutes left. I will like to call Ms. Kayla Flanagan, if she's on. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hi, my name is Kayla Flanagan. Prior to getting services from Hope for Youth, my childhood home was foreclosed. I had a criminal record from my teenage years that prevented me from getting housing, so I was living in my car. I first accessed the Hope for Youth drop-in center in 2017. I was able to come and grab food from the food shelf. I could get clothing from the clothing closet, and I got a warm meal each night. I also had access to showers and laundry facilities here at the drop-in center. The drop-in center staff assisted with getting me into Hope Place, which is a transitional housing program with 12 studio apartments. After leaving Hope Place, I now had rental history, so I was able to get into an apartment. I've been living with a friend from Hope Place for 2 years now. One thing I really appreciate about Hope for Youth is they don't stop helping you when you find housing. They're here to support you through the whole journey. I've been working with a case manager here at the drop-in center for over a year now. She supports me with employment, my mental health, and so much more. Last winter, the heat went out and my roommate in my apartment, and if you remember, it was really cold. Hope for Youth offered to get my roommate and I a hotel until our heat was turned back on. Last spring, my car broke down in the parking lot here at the Hope for Youth drop-in center, and Hope for Youth helped coordinate getting my car towed to a local shop and assisted me with paying for the car repairs. They also offered me an Uber gift card when that happened so that I could still come and get services, and I was still able to go like pick up medication and anything that I needed.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. Members, do we have any questions? We have 2 minutes for Chair Stevenson and his testifiers. Hearing none, Chair Stevenson, any quick close of comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. Thank you, committee, for your attention. I hope it can earn your support. This is an awesome project. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, Ms. Williams, and special thanks to Ms. Flanagan for sharing the experience that you have. Members, our next meeting is Thursday, March 3rd. On the agenda will be updates from the Public Facilities Authority and the Department of Health on lead service lines and related bills. As a reminder, all bills will be heard on an informational basis only. This meeting is adjourned.